Chapter 5. An Unexpected Meeting. To spend a few days on board a yacht with the same companions is a very good demonstration of one's need to surround himself with sympathetic vibrations. I found it so. I might as well have been quite alone on the Diana as with Morton Harland and his daughter, though they tried to be kind to me and thoughtful of my comfort. But between us there yawned a wide chasm. Catherine Harland made feeble efforts now and then to hail me across that chasm, but her strength failed her. Dr. Braille, with a subconscious feeling that I knew him for a medical charlatan, had naturally warned her against me as a dangerous theorist. I therefore shut myself within a strong citadel of inward reserve. Dr. Braille and Mr. Harland, unable to resist the temptation, did their best to have a little fun at my expense. They tried to draw me out on my opinions, especially on religious or scientific matters, but on other subjects as well. I just as determinedly ignored their questions and talked about the weather. It amused me not a little to see that my determination not to play their game at first surprised them both, then disappointed them, and finally annoyed them. I smiled inwardly, but talked as conventional women do everywhere, of the weather, of the speed we were making, of the fish that frequented such and such waters. I was resolved not to lift the line of thought up in the air, in the manner whereof I had often been accused, but to keep it at ground level. When we left Tobermory, where we had anchored for a couple of days, the large yacht was becoming rather too cramped for us, and a monotony was beginning to set in that threatened to engulf us. As the Diana steamed along through the drowsy, misty light of the summer afternoon, past the jagged coast of the mainland, I sat on deck quite by myself, watching the purple haze that slightly veiled the mountains of Ardmurchan and Mordart, wondering whether it might not be better after all to write my friend Francesca and tell her that her prophecies had been fulfilled already, and that I was beginning to weary of a holiday passed in an atmosphere so lacking in joy, and might she expect me in Inverness Shire at once? Yet I was reluctant to end my cruise with the Harlands too soon. There was in my heart a secret wish that I hardly breathed to myself, a wish that I might see once again the strange sailing vessel that had so suddenly appeared and disappeared. I had to confess a desire to meet and make the acquaintance of its owner. Surely, I reasoned, it would be at least an interesting break in the present condition of things. I did not know then, as I know now, why my mind so persistently returned to the fancied personality of the unknown owner of the mysterious craft that, as Captain Derrick put it, sailed without wind. Still, I found myself always thinking about him and trying to visualize his face and form. Again and again I took myself to task for what seemed a foolish mental attitude, but do what I would, the interest remained. Perhaps it was encouraged by the apparently fadeless quality of the pink bell heather which I'd received from that weird-looking Highland fellow who called himself Jamie. For though 3 or 4 days had now passed since I first wore it, it showed no signs of withering. As a rule, the delicate waxen bells of this plant turn yellow a few hours after they are plucked. My little bunch, however, was as bright and fresh as ever. I kept it in a glass without water on the table in my sitting room, and it looked always the same. I wondered what I should do if my surroundings remained as they were. Should I go on with the Diana for a while longer, on the chance of seeing the strange yacht again? Or should I resolve to leave the ship at some point from which I could reach Inverness easily? Just then Mr. Harland came up behind my chair and laid his hand on my shoulder. "Are you in dreamland?" he inquired, and I thought his voice sounded a little dispirited. "There's a wonderful light on those hills just now." I raised my eyes and saw the purple rise and become scattered by the long rays of late afternoon sunshine, pouring like golden wine through the dividing wreaths of vapor. Above, the sky was a pure turquoise blue. Near the line of the gray sea, the turquoise melted into pale opal and emerald, and under the freshening breeze showed little flecks of white foam. Bringing my gaze away from the dazzling radiance of the heavens, I turned to Mr. Harland and was shocked to see the drawn, livid pallor of his face and the anguish of his expression. "My dear Mr. Harland," I exclaimed, "you are ill." I sprang up in haste to offer him my chair. "Do please sit down." He made a mute gesture of denial and with slow difficulty drew another chair up beside mine, dropping into it with a heavy air of exhaustion. "I am not ill now," he said. "A little while ago, I was very ill and in pain, horrible pain. Braille did what he could for me, but it was not much. He says I must expect to suffer now and again until the end." Impulsively, I laid my hand on his. "I am so very sorry," I said gently. "I wish I could be of some use to you." He looked at me with a curious wistfulness. "You could, no doubt, if I believed as you do," he replied, and then was silent for a moment. Presently he spoke again. "Do you know, I've been a little disappointed in you." "Have you?" I smiled a little. "Why?" He did not answer at once, seeming absorbed in troubled musings. When he resumed, it was in a low, meditative tone, almost as if he were speaking to himself. "When I first met you at one of those social crushes, you remember, which make the London season so infinitely tedious, I was told you were gifted with unusual psychic power and that you had in yourself the secret of an abounding, exhaustless vitality. This interested me, because I consider most of our modern men and women only half alive. I heard of you that it did people good to be in your company, that your influence upon them was uplifting, and that there was some unknown form of occult or psychic science to which you had devoted years of study, with the result that you stood, as it were, apart from the world, though in it. This is, as I say, what I heard." "But you did not believe it," I interposed. "Why do you say that?" he asked quickly. "Because I know you could not believe it," I answered. "It would be impossible for you." A gleam of satire flashed in his sunken eyes. "Well, you are right there. I did not believe it. But I expected." "I know," and I laughed. "You expected what is called a singular woman, one who makes herself singular, who adopts singular poses, and who is altogether removed from ordinary humanity. And of course you are disappointed. I am not a veiled priestess." "It is not that," he said with a little vexation. "When I saw you, I recognized you as a transparent creature, devoted to innocent but beautiful dreams. I thought it might be refreshing to be around you. Alas, that secret you are reported to possess, the secret of wonderful, abounding, exhaustless vitality, how does it happen that you have it? I myself see it in your every glance and gesture. What puzzles me is how to define it, and also why you hide yourself from us." I was silent. "When you joined us on this cruise a few days ago, you brought a kind of atmosphere with you that almost uplifted me. Now I am disappointed. You seem to have enclosed yourself in it, leaving us out." "Is it not you who have left yourselves out?" I queried gently. "I personally have really nothing to do with it. Just remember that when we have talked on any subject above the line of the general and commonplace, your sole object has been to draw me for your own amusement and that of Dr. Braille." "Ah, you saw that, did you?" he said with a faint smile. "Naturally. Had you believed half you say you were told of me, you would have known I must have seen it. Can you wonder that I refuse to be drawn?" He looked at me with an odd expression of mingled surprise and annoyance, and I met his gaze fully and frankly. His eyes shifted uneasily away. "One may feel a pardonable curiosity," he said, "and a desire to know." "To know what?" I asked with some warmth. How can you obtain what you are secretly craving for if you persist in denying what is true? You are afraid of death, yet you invite it by ignoring the source of life. The curtain is down. You struggle outside the eternal realities altogether in a chaos of your own making. I spoke with some passion, and he heard me patiently. Let us try to understand each other, he said after a pause. Though it will be difficult. You speak of eternal realities. To me, there are none, save the constant scattering and reuniting of atoms. These, as far as we know, of the extraordinary and to me quite unintelligent plan of the universe, are forever shifting and changing into various forms and clusters of forms, such as solar systems, planets, comets, stardust, and the like. Our present view of them is chiefly based on the researches of Larmor and Thomson of Cambridge. From them and from other scientists, we learn that electricity exists in small particles which we can see, in a manner of speaking, in the cathode rays. And these particles are called electrons. These compose atoms of matter. Well, there are a trillion atoms in every granule of dust. Well, electrons are so much smaller that 100,000 of them can live in the diameter of an atom. I know all this. But I do not know why the atoms or electrons should exist at all, nor what cause there should be for their constant and often violent state of movement. They apparently always have been and always will be. Therefore, they are all that can be called eternal realities. Sir Norman Lockyer tells us that the matter of the universe is undergoing a continuous process of evolution. But even if that is so, what is it to me, individually? It neither helps nor consoles me for being an infinitesimal spark in the general conflagration. Now you believe in the force that is behind your system of electrons and atoms, I interrupted promptly. For by whatever means or substances the universe is composed, a mighty intelligence must govern it. I look to the cause and not only to the effect. For even if I am an infinitesimal part of the whole, I am part of the stream. An abstract, lifeless principle, without will or intention or intelligence, could not have evolved the splendors of nature or the intellectual capabilities of man. It could not have given rise to what was not. He fixed his eyes steadily upon me. That last sentence is sound argument, he said, as though reluctantly admitting the obvious. And I suppose I am to presume that itself is the wellspring from which you draw, or imagine you draw, your psychic force? If I have any psychic force at all, I replied, where do you suppose it came from? But from that which gives vitality to all animate nature? I cannot understand why you blind yourself to the open and visible fact of a divine intelligence working in and through all things. If you could but acknowledge it, and set yourself in tune with it, you would find life a new and far more wonderful adventure than it is to you now. I firmly believe that your very illness has arisen from your determined unbelief. That's what a Christian Scientist would say, he answered with a touch of scorn. I begin to think Dr. Braille is right in his estimate of you. I held my peace. Have you no curiosity? He demanded. Don't you want to know his opinion?
No, and I smiled. My dear Mr. Harlan, with all your experience of the world, has it never occurred to you that some people's opinions simply don't matter?
Braille is a clever man, he said somewhat testily, and you are merely an imaginative woman.
Then why do you trouble about me? I asked him quickly. Why do you want to find out that something in me which baffles both Dr. Braille and yourself? It was now his turn to be silent, and he remained so for some time, his eyes fixed on the shadowing heavens. The waves were roughening slightly, and a swell from the Atlantic lifted the Diana over their foam-flecked crests as she plowed her way swiftly along. Presently he turned to me with a smile.
Let us strike a truce, he said. I promise not to try and draw you any more, but please do not isolate yourself from us. Try to feel that we are your friends. I want you, if possible, to enjoy this cruise.
I've begun to fear that we are proving rather dull company for you. We are making for Skye at good speed, and shall probably anchor in Loch Scavaig tonight. Tomorrow we might land and do the excursion to Loch Carusk. Perhaps you'd care to do that, though I'm afraid Catherine is not a good walker. I felt somewhat remorseful, for he said these words in a kindly tone. Yet I knew very well that, notwithstanding all the strenuous efforts which might be made to suit the conventional rules of courtesy, it would be impossible for me to feel really at home in the surroundings he'd created for himself. However, I resolved to make the best of the situation in which I found myself, and to steer clear of anything that might draw the line of demarcation too strongly between us. And because some instinct told me that present conditions would change, I answered my host gently, assuring him of my willingness to fall in with his plans. Our conversation drifted gradually then to more ordinary topics. Toward sunset, I went down to my cabin to dress for dinner. I had a fancy to wear the bunch of pink bell heather that still maintained its delicacy of bloom. This, then, fastened in the lace of my white gown, was my only adornment. That night everyone made a distinct attempt to be sociable and pleasant. Catherine Harlan, for once, was quite cheerful, and proposed quite chattily that, since the moonlight was lovely, we should all go after dinner into the deck saloon where there was a piano, and that I should sing for them. I was pleasantly surprised at her suggestion, for she was not fond of music. Nevertheless, she and her father had shown so evidently a wish to lighten the fog of monotony that had been creeping over us all that I agreed readily to do anything that might perhaps give them any momentary pleasure. We went up on deck, therefore, and on arriving there were all smitten into an awed silence by the beauty of the scene. Our yacht was anchored in Loch Scavaig, and the moonlight fell on the surrounding hills with a ghostly splendor, its pale beams touching summits here and there, and deepening the solemn impression the lake made, with the magnificent Sentinel Mountain surrounding it. A low murmur of invisible streams made a soothing backdrop for the deep stillness that surrounded us, enhancing the fascination of the scene before us. Everything seemed more like the landscape of a dream than a firm reality. Deep spans of darkness among the cavernous slopes were broken at intervals by unexpected rifts of light, reflected upward by the palpitating water, which now and again gleamed with pale emerald and gold phosphorescence. The stars appeared large and white, like straying wisps of the moon. The mysterious lapping of slow ripples against the sides of the yacht suggested the whisperings of innumerable spirits. We stood in a group, entranced to silence by the splendor of the night surrounding us, and by our own solitude within it. There was no sign of human life anywhere, no fisherman's hut, no boat moored to the shore, nothing that might have provided us a sense of human presence. Suddenly, a curious wisp of disappointment rose within me. I raised my eyes with a kind of mute appeal to the vastness above me, as moon and stars appeared as though floating in the heavens like ships in a deep sea. I had gazed at the eerie landscape with a mute appeal. Yet, I asked myself, why should I expect anything? Beautiful as was the scene around me, and fully aware as I was of its beauty, an overpowering depression suddenly gripped me, and the dreary emptiness of this vast solitude weighed on my spirit. I moved a little apart from my companions. Leaning over the railing, I looked searchingly into the dark shadows of the shore, made all the darker by the contrasting brilliance of the moon, and my thoughts flew, not lightly, but heavily, toward the even darker line of my life's horizon. For the moment, I lost my usual sense of joy. How wretched, I thought, are we human creatures. What hope is there for us, after all, imprisoned as we are in a world without a care for us, whatever our fate. A world that cares not whether we live or die, work to improve it or do nothing. The barren hills around us, the cold lake, the white moon, all these were here, unchanged and unaffected when Caesar lived. They would be here still when we who now gazed upon them had vanished into the unknown. Supposing towns or villages had ever existed on these desolate shores, they had shown themselves powerless against the devouring forces of nature, even as the buried cities in South America, despite their reputed magnificence, had been powerless. Even as the golden age of Lanka in Ceylon, more than 2,000 years ago, now lay buried in the sands of time. Of what avail, I thought, are our human struggles? Is this world here for the benefit of anything or anyone? And what of the toil and sorrow of countless millions? Is it perhaps only for the uplift and perfection of a few individuals? Is this what was meant in the saying, many are called, but few are chosen? Why then this waste of brain and heart and love and patience? Tears suddenly came into my eyes. I started as if from a bad dream when Dr. Braille approached me softly from behind. I'm sorry to disturb your reverie, he said, but Miss Harland has gone into the deck saloon and we are all waiting to hear you sing. I glanced up at him. I don't feel as if I could sing tonight, I replied a little tremulously. This lonely landscape depresses me. He saw moisture in my eyes and smiled. You are overwrought, he said. Your theories are not infallible. You must be cared for. You think too much. Or too little, I suggested. Really, my dear lady, one cannot possibly think too little, where health and happiness are concerned. The sanest and most comfortable people on earth are those who eat well and never think at all. An empty brain and a full stomach, these are what make up a contented life. So you imagine, I said with a gesture of slightly veiled disdain. So I know, he replied. I've had a wide experience. Now don't look daggers at me. Come and sing. He offered me his arm, but I ignored it and walked unaided towards the deck saloon. There I found Mr. Harlan and Catherine seated together. The lights were turned fully on, completely eclipsing the radiance of the moon that shone through the windows. The piano stood open. As I came in, Catherine looked at me with an air of surprise. Why, how pale you are, she exclaimed. One would think you had seen a ghost. I laughed. Perhaps I have. Lough Scavaig is a setting sufficient for any number of ghosts. It is so lonely. A slight tremor ran through me as I played a few soft chords. What shall I sing to you? Something of the country we are in, said Mr. Harland. Do you know any old, wild Gaelic air? I thought for a moment, and then to a low, rippling accompaniment, I sang the old Celtic fairy's love song. Why should I sit and sigh? Why should I sit and sigh on the hillside dreary? When I see the plover rising or the curlew wheeling, then I know my mortal lover back to me is stealing. When the day wears away, sad I gaze adown the valley. Every sound heard around sets my heart a-thrilling. Why should I sit and sigh? Why should I sit and sigh, all alone and weary? Ah, but there is something wanting. Oh, but I am weary. Come, my true and tender lover, o'er the hills to cheer me. Why should I sit and sigh? Why should I sit and sigh, all alone and weary? I had scarcely finished the last verse when Captain Derrick suddenly appeared at the door of the saloon in a state of great excitement. Come out, Mr. Harlan, he almost shouted. Come quickly, all of you. There's that strange yacht again. I rose from my seat at the piano, trembling a little. At last, I thought, at last. Though I could not explain even to myself the emotion I felt, my heart was pounding tumultuously. In a moment, we were all standing on deck, speechless and amazed by what, I thought, must have been the most wonderful sight ever seen by human eyes. There, on the dark, lonely waters of Lac Skavag, was poised, surely not anchored, the fairy vessel of a dream. All its sails were spread, sails as white as milk and glistening with a dewy radiance. They shone against the somber background with an almost blinding splendor. The whole crew of sailors and servants on the Diana came together in astonished groups, whispering among themselves. All of them were evidently more or less frightened by this strange spectacle. Captain Derrick waited for someone to hazard a remark. Then, as we remained silent, he addressed Mr. Harlan. "Well, sir, what do you make of it?" Mr. Harlan gave no answer. For a man who professed indifference to everything, he seemed for once startled and even a little afraid. Catherine caught me by the arm. She was shivering nervously.
"Do you think it is a real yacht?"
she whispered. I was amused at her question, considering that she was a woman who denied the supernatural. "What else could it be?" I answered. "Don't you see people moving about on board?" Indeed, in the brilliant light shed by those extraordinary sails, the schooner appeared to be fully manned. Several of her crew were busy on deck. There was nothing phantom-like about their movements.
"Her sails are obviously lit up by electricity," Dr. Brayle announced self-importantly. "Yet I couldn't say how it is done."
"She came into the lock like a flash," said Captain Derrick.
"I saw her slide in around that point, and then without the slightest sound, she was safely anchored before you could whistle. She behaved just the same way when we first sighted her off Mull."
I listened to what they were saying, somewhat impatient with their speculations. "Why not exchange courtesies?" I suggested. "Here we are, two yachts anchored near each other on a lonely lake. Shouldn't we get to know each other? That way all your conjectures would be resolved."
"Quite true," said Mr. Harlan, breaking his silence at last. "But isn't it a little late to visit? What time is it?"
"About 10:30, said Dr. Brayle, glancing at his watch.
"Oh, let's go to bed,"
Miss Catherine murmured pleadingly.
"What's the good of making inquiries tonight?"
"Well, if we don't make them tonight," said Captain Derrick bluntly, 10 to 1, you won't have a chance tomorrow. That yacht will do as it did before and vanish before sunrise."
"As specters are supposed to do," said Dr. Brayle, with a superior smile. "With ghosts, I think it is a tradition."
Lighting a cigarette, he began to smoke it with a careless air.
"I vote for catching our specter before it vanishes."
While this talk went on, Mr. Harlan stepped back into the saloon and wrote a note, enclosing it in a sealed envelope. With this in hand, he came out to us again.
"Captain, will you get the boat lowered, please?" he said.
Then, as Captain Derrick hurried to obey his order, he turned to his secretary.
"Mr. Swinton, take this note with my compliments to the owner of the yacht, whoever he may be. Give it to no one but him."
Mr. Swinton, looking pale and uncomfortable, took the note gingerly.
The owner? Yes, he stammered. "And if there is no one?"
"What do you mean?"
Mr. Harlan frowned in his own peculiar way.
"There's sure to be someone, even if it be the devil. You can say to him that the ladies of our party are very much interested in the beautiful illumination of his yacht, and that we'll be glad to see him on board ours if he cares to come. Be as polite as you can, and as agreeable as you like."
"Has it not occurred to you?" faltered Mr. Swinton uneasily,
glancing sideways at the glistening sails.
"I suppose you have not thought that it may be an illusion, a sort of atmospheric mirage?"
Mr. Harland allowed himself to laugh, the heartiest I had ever heard from him.
"Upon my word, Swinton," he exclaimed, "I should never have thought you capable of nerves. Come, come, be off with you. The boat is lowered. All's ready."
Thus commanded, the reluctant Mr. Swinton could do nothing but obey. I could not help smiling at his evident discomfiture. All his precise manner and self-satisfaction were gone in a moment, and he revealed himself nothing but a very timorous creature, afraid to investigate what he could not immediately understand. The sailors, however, who were to row him over to the yacht, displayed no such terrors.
they, like their captain, were eager to resolve the mystery, if mystery there was. All of us, united in a single instinct, pressed to the gangway as Mr. Swinton descended the companion ladder and entered the boat. The boat then glided away with a low and rhythmic plash of its oars. We watched it draw nearer and nearer to the illuminated vessel, our excitement growing in intensity all the while. For once, Mr. Harland and his daughter had forgotten themselves. Catherine's customary expression of misery was gone altogether in the keenness of her interest in something more immediately absorbing than her own ailments. And where I was concerned, during the few minutes between the boat's departure and its arrival by the strange yacht, I could hardly endure the suspense tugging on every nerve of my body. My thoughts were in a whirl. It seemed to me that something momentous, perhaps even terrifying, was on the point of happening.
"There they go,"
cried Mr. Harland. He, too, had caught my unbearable feeling of suspense.
"They're alongside. See, those fellows are lowering the companion ladder. Well,"
he relaxed with a low chuckle,
"there's nothing supernatural about them. Swinton's all right. Look, he's on board."
We strained our eyes through the brilliance shed by the illuminated sails on the darkness. Mr. Swinton was talking to a group of sailors. One of them went away, then returned almost immediately, followed by a man clad in white yachting flannels, the owner of the yacht, surely. This man, as he stood by one of the shining sails, caught some of its light on his own figure, and the effect undeniably became him. As I stood gazing at him, the impression struck me like a lightning bolt. He was no stranger. I had seen him before. This sudden awareness was swiftly borne in upon me, calming all my previous mental tumult and relieving me of any anxiety regarding the possible result of our acquaintance. Catherine Harland was pressing my arm excitedly.
"There he is," she cried. "He must be the owner of the yacht. He's reading Father's letter."
We could see him turning the sheet of paper in his hands. Just then, as we waited and wondered what his answer would be, the light on the yacht's sails paled and died away, beam after radiant beam, slipping off like drops of water. Before we could quite realize it, there was darkness where only moments before all had been brilliance. The canvas was hauled down, and with the extinction of that light, all sight of the human figures on deck was gone. We could not imagine what would happen next. The dark shore looked darker than ever. The yacht's outline was now truly spectral, like a dim cobweb against the moon. In silence, we looked questioningly at one another. Mr. Harland then spoke in a low tone.
"The boat is coming back," he said. "I hear oars rowing."
I leaned over the side of our vessel and tried to gaze through the gloom. How still the water seemed. Not a ripple disturbed its surface. But there were strange glimmers of light in its depth. They appeared like sunken jewels lost on the sand far below. The regular plying of the oars sounded nearer and nearer. My heart beat with painful rapidity. I could not comprehend this strange feeling. It overpowered me, as though my very soul were stretching out to reach the oncoming boat, as the sound of it grew in magnitude through the darkness. A brief interval later, and we saw the boat enter a patch of moonlight on the water. We were able to perceive Mr. Swinton seated in the stern. Another figure sat beside him. This figure stood up as the boat neared us and raised his cap in friendly salutation. Then, as his dinghy came alongside our ship, the graceful figure caught the guide rope and sprang lightly onto the first step of the companion ladder.
"Why, he's actually come over to us himself," ejaculated Mr. Harland, and hurried over to the gangway,
just in time to receive the visitor as he stepped onto the deck.
"Well, Harlan, how are you?" said a mellow voice in the cheeriest of accents. "How strange it is that we should meet like this, after so many years."